Welcome to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. This year's flu season is a bad one. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention has classified it as an epidemic and reported that hospitalizations across the country have roughly doubled over the same period last year. In Ohio, flu symptoms forced a record 1,700 people to hospitals during the first week of January alone. Joining us is Medical Director of the Ohio Department of Health, Dr. Clint Koenig. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Ann.
Why is this year so bad?
It has to do with a few factors. One has to do with the fact that in central Ohio, we've had such cold weather in our current season. And the other fact has to do with the type of virus that's circulating. And the type of virus that's circulating is particularly nasty. It's called the H3N2 virus. And it's a similar strain to what we saw back in the 2014-2015 season, which was bad, as well as the 2011 and 2012 season, which was also bad as well.
Why does cold weather affect it?
Because the virus likes cold weather to survive.
This particular one or
yes,
in general?
Influenza viruses really like cold weather. Rhinoviruses or the common cold viruses also really like cold weather. Other viruses like warm weather. So there's a kind of what they call the summer illness or summer flu, which is really not the flu. That tends to like warmer temperatures, more like at the end of August. So this one really just likes cold weather and lives well.
And the summer one, it is a virus, but it's not the flu.
No, it's actually called an echovirus, but it's a different strain. But when people get really sick at the end of summer and they think, oh my gosh, this could be flu, it's really a different virus strain than what we're seeing.
You're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. With me is the medical director for the Ohio Department of Health, Dr. Clint Koenig. We're talking about flu season, and I welcome your calls. We've got about 15 minutes, 10 or 15 minutes left. So if you have a question or comment for Dr. Koenig, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. I was listening to NPR yesterday, and they said that they were noting the number of deaths nationwide, and they said that that didn't even count older people.
Right.
Why is that significant? Why not count older people? Is that because they're already more vulnerable and it doesn't say the same thing?
I think it has to do with how they define illness. Older people that die of the flu may actually have what's called influenza-like symptoms.
Okay.
So they're not actually being categorized as the flu because no one's actually testing them for the flu. So what we look at is our hospitalizations and deaths that have been confirmed for the flu. So we also know that this type of virus, H3N2, really affects kids as well as older adults, particularly harder than other flu strains. So it's really important to make sure that older adults as well as children over 6 months get a flu shot. That's really the most important way to prevent the flu.
And what do we mean by older adults?
Well, it actually has to do
with... Be gentle.
Yes, that's... I'm trying to be as diplomatic as possible. The CDC and other studies define older adults as anyone over the age of 65. Some actually consider older... over the age of 55. So, I think
and that's because
problem.
Those two age groups had not been exposed to this in the past, or why do particular? Is it because sometimes it's because they haven't been exposed to it, but other times it's just because younger children and older adults are more vulnerable.
Yeah, it's less about exposure. It's more about the maturity of the immune system.
Okay.
So in kids younger than 6 months, and particularly between 3 and 6 months, that's when they're most vulnerable because very young children lose maternal immunity or immunity from their moms. And they haven't really had a full chance to develop their own mature immune system. And then on the other side of the spectrum, older adults tend to lose immunity. So it's not that they don't have good immune systems, but there's a syndrome and a factor that goes on where they just the immune system just isn't as strong as it is in non-older adults. So it's really an immune system issue.
Mike in Hebron, you're on the air. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I wanted to ask the doctor. I have many friends who have had the flu. Some of us have, and myself included, have had it, took about 2 weeks, went to the doctor, got some medication, et cetera, et cetera. But I have some friends who get over it and get it again. and then they get it again.
Wow.
And each time it almost seems to be worse. Any suggestions you can have for people to try and avoid that relapse?
Huh, interesting. Good question.
Yeah, thanks, Mike. That's a really great question. I think there's a couple of things in terms of getting it again. The first question I would have in something like that is the second illness really the flu? Mm. Or is it another virus that could have come on the backside of the flu, or even a sinus infection or a pneumonia? Because really what happens after the flu is that leaves, once the flu dies and goes away, that really leaves your breathing system, your respiratory system, vulnerable to other viruses and other bacteria that are out there. So that actually makes them more susceptible. In terms of actually preventing it or you know, helping to prevent the chance of getting it again, there's a couple of things. I think there's some of the basic good hand washing, making sure you're not around individuals that are sick or have the flu. I mean, the general zone that we talk about is anywhere from 3 to 6 feet. Also, just making sure that you're not touching things that other sick people could have touched, like doorknobs, for example. There's also some non-science-based recommendations or non-strong evidence, but also thinking about making sure that you sleep upright or having some, you know, so that there's good exchange of information. And also avoiding anti-cough medicines because, you know, really when you're getting better.
Suppressants then.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. So you really want to make sure that when you start to cough, that's your body beginning to clear whatever junk is out there. And you really want to make sure that that gets out.
How do you know that it's time to go see a doctor about your symptoms? Some people like to really tough it out. I happen to be one of those people that going to a doctor for the flu, it's just not the way I was raised. But you should.
Yeah, I really think it depends on a few things. I think some of the most important things is, you know, if you have a condition that puts you at risk for complications of the flu.
Okay.
So that could
asthma.
Be asthma,
mm-hmm.
diabetes, lung disease, smokers. Any time that you have a really bad illness like the flu with high fevers and muscle aches and you have those conditions, that puts you more at risk for hospitalizations and really serious complications. So that's really an opportune time to go see your doctor. Any other issues could include the fact of high fevers, not being able to take care of yourself, general self-care measures that you're not able to do when you're well would be another reason to seek medical treatment. Also, other high-risk individuals, including pregnant women, as well as children, could also be appropriate candidates for the anti-flu medications, Tamiflu and Relenzers and Amivir. So the anti-flu medications given to high-risk populations can actually shorten the duration, and obviously only a doctor or prescriber can prescribe those.
How many deaths have occurred in Ohio so far that we know of?
Well, we have 3 confirmed pediatric deaths. I don't have the specific data on the actual mortality. I can tell you in Ohio over the past week, we've had 206 associated hospitalizations. And that so far we've had 1,750 confirmed associated hospitalizations, which is an 88% increase from the week previous. So we're really actually going high with our projections. And according to the CDC, peak season might be around now or in a few weeks, so we might actually be hitting the peak. We're hoping that that's the case.
What do things like Tamiflu, the anti-flu medications, do?
They shorten the duration of symptoms.
How do they do that?
Sure. So the class of medications are called neuraminidase inhibitors. And when you hear flu viruses being called H3N2, H1N1, it really attacks the N part of that. So what it does is it keeps the virus from opening up and spreading its cells, its germs to the other cells of the body. So it's what's called a neuraminidase inhibitor. So it inhibits the ability for that virus to open up and then infect the cells of the body.
It's been reported that this year's flu shot isn't as effective against that strain, H3N2, but people should still be getting the flu shot anyway?
Absolutely. The data that's been thrown around in the media has been about 10%, and that came from the Australian flu season. So they, because of where they are in the world, have
their
flu
season.
They get it first. And really what we're seeing in Ohio is the efficacy rate's about 30%. So we say 30% is better than 100% chance. So we really do encourage and continue to encourage individuals to get a flu shot. Traditionally, the range of getting a flu shot's usually from October to January, but because of the duration of the season and the severity of it, we're going to continue to recommend it past
January. Okay, so it's still worth the trouble to get it.
Absolutely.
If you haven't yet.
It takes about 2 weeks for full effectiveness once you get the immunization.
Okay. How are Ohio hospitals dealing with these increased numbers? Are they okay so far?
I think there's some hospitals that are having real difficulty up to, you know, when we had the pandemic issue of 2009. So there are some hospitals that are had to, as I understand, go on diversion because of their numbers being so high. They've had to put people in the emergency room and keep them in the emergency room versus admitting them. What I'm hearing anecdotally now is that that's getting slightly better. However, it's been an issue.
And how's Ohio doing compared to the rest of the country?
So one of the things that the CDC has mentioned that we're kind of all under widespread. So all of the United States is having significant issues with the flu. So we're not faring any better or worse. We're really in the thick of it as we are with so many other states.
If you have the flu, should you always go to a doctor, or is it okay to try to tough it out if you don't have any of those pre-existing conditions that you talked about earlier?
I think it's really up to the individual and how they feel. If they don't feel like they can take care of themselves or have somebody take care of them, then that would be a really good opportunity to go to the emergency room. If they are concerned that they may be getting a pneumonia from the flu, because bacteria can sometimes creep in and cause a pneumonia-like situation, which could be very serious. Mm-hmm. That would be something. So really, it's symptoms, but it's also the inability to manage those symptoms and or concern about symptoms like pneumonia that could happen on top of that. So those are really indications for people to seek medical attention who may otherwise be healthy.
Richard, in Grove City, you're on the air with the medical director of the Ohio Department of Health, Dr. Clint Koenig. Hi, Richard.
Hey there.
Go ahead.
Question is, I received a flu shot back in September and been doing well, but 2 weeks ago I got what I believe to be flu symptoms and I've been somewhat ill with upper respiratory. Is it helpful to get a second flu shot? Does that do anything?
Yeah.
Great question, Richard. Probably not.
Because they can't change up the flu shots to respond H3N2.
Right. And luckily, the flu shots that are out there now do cover H3N2.
Oh, okay.
Now, the question is, because of H3N2 being what it is, it mutates naturally, and it's possible that you could have gotten an H3N2 virus, Richard, that changed from the time that it entered into the flu shot to the time it actually is circulating out in the community. The other point, Richard, is that as we move on in the seasons, we move on from influenza A to influenza B. And the issue with influenza B and the traditional shots that we've had in the past is that the influenza B, two of the influenza B strains are typically covered now. In what's called the quadrivalent vaccine. In the past, we've used trivalent vaccines, so that only has one influenza B. So, Richard, to your point, it is possible you could have gotten the H3N2 or another non-typable flu strain that just wasn't in the vaccine, or it's possible you could have had another virus that was out there that was acting like the flu. There are other viruses that people can interpret to be the flu but actually are completely separate viruses.
Should he get a second flu shot then, or are you recommending that? Or?
No,
okay.
We wouldn't recommend that.
All right, okay. All right, Richard, thank you for that question. Mark in Clintonville, you're on the air. Hi, Mark.
Hello. As a critical care nurse, on a lot of days we can see up to a quarter of our beds filled with flu patients, and a number of those are intubated and on maximal ventilator support, while others are on high-intensity, non-invasive oxygen therapy.
Uh-huh.
This is nothing to not take seriously.
Okay.
You can wind up in very serious condition.
Do these patients, are they tending to be the younger and the older set, or is it?
They cover the whole age spectrum, from their 40s to their 60s to their 70s.
And do you know if they're getting the flu shots and they're getting in this sick like this in spite of it?
We do flu screenings with every admission, and anywhere there is a good percentage of them that just don't bother with the flu screen, the flu vaccination.
Yeah. Another thing, and thank you, Mark, for that call. I appreciate it. Another thing, Dr. Koenig, is let's talk about the flu shot and why it is important for people to get it, because some people can't get the flu shot. They are allergic to it. They have other conditions that prevent them from getting it, and that leaves them very vulnerable.
Right. So there are very, very few reasons not to get a flu shot. One is you've gotten the flu shot and you've gotten a severe allergic reaction. Previously, allergies to eggs was thought not to be a reason to get a flu shot.
Mm-hmm.
But right now, the CDC has determined that a previous allergy to eggs is not a reason to avoid a flu shot. The other are certain other conditions. One is called Guillain-Barré syndrome. If someone's had a history of Guillain-Barré, that would be another reason. But outside of those few limitations, there's really no reason not to get a flu shot. And also, just to speak to the egg issue, the egg issue is a reason why we see some mutations in the H3N2. And luckily, next year, we're moving, or the CDC, or the World Health Organization, are moving to a vaccine that's actually not grown in eggs. So the whole issue about egg versus non-egg shouldn't be a problem with next year's flu.
When they find out that something different, in this case, H3N2 is more dominant, and it wasn't in the first flu shots, or why can't they just change the flu shots? What's the process to develop those shots?
Right. The World Health Organization determines the flu shots several months in advance. So, for example, next year's flu shot is going to be determined in February of 2018. So,
but why?
Because they have to predict and they have to then scale up all of the production to say this is what we're going to need. And to actually get those machines and those gears rolling, it takes several months to not only determine the right combination of flu that's going to, or the flu strains that are going to be in the flu shot, but then they have to then tell the pharmaceutical industry, who then has to scale up and produce millions and millions of doses. I mean, for now, the pharmaceutical industry has delivered 150 million doses this flu season. So to go from theory to 151 million doses takes a lot of planning and effort.
Hmm. Katie and Powell, you're on the air. Hi, Katie.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, thanks.
I have a quick question about what the doctor's view is on how effective elderberry syrup is. Apparently, it's able to attach to pretty much any kind of virus.
Dr. Koenig?
That's a good question, Katie. I don't know the efficacy of elderberry specifically. There are some areas that are being looked at, such as high-dose and medium-dose vitamin D, for example, that acts as kind of an immune function modulator that actually can show some reduction. But I'm not specifically aware of elderberry.
Okay. Katie, thanks a lot for that call. Caroline in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Caroline.
Hello. I really appreciate the topic today. And prior to an experience that I've had this week, I have really just thought that the flu is something that populations who are susceptible to additional consequences of the flu really need to pay attention to, and I really didn't think about myself.
Mm-hmm.
Just last week, my first cousin, who lives in the Cincinnati area, lost her aunt, who was in her 50s, due to complications with the flu.
Wow.
She was admitted to a Cincinnati hospital with the flu, contracted pneumonia, and passed away. Made her a very special case is that she also had diabetes. And there's it's obviously not known if that was linked to the complications with the flu. But I really appreciate that you're on today and you're giving the information about how to prevent it and when to go see your doctor.
Carolyn, we're so sorry for your loss. Thank you for calling in and sharing the story with us. But, there's an increase in the number of people with diabetes.
That's right. And Carolyn brings up a really good point that diabetes can be an underlying chronic condition that predisposes individuals who get the flu to very serious complications. And diabetes in and of itself can affect the immune system in such ways to help reduce the body's response to flu. So in addition to getting a flu vaccine every year, we also recommend people that have diabetes get pneumonia shots and other appropriate vaccinations. So if you do have diabetes, please talk to your healthcare provider and talk about the other recommended vaccines as well. And to your point, Anne, certainly with our epidemic of obesity, we tend to see more of what's called the type 2 diabetes. And that's very important to get screened and checked for that as well.
Caroline, thanks for sharing that. Really appreciate
it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Dr. Clint Koenig, I kept you over because we had those calls coming in and it's so important. And I thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you, Anne. It's been a pleasure being here.
Dr. Clint Koenig is the medical director for the Ohio Department of Health. More Wellness Wednesdays coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. A movement against tap and filtered water has attracted the attention of health experts for all the wrong reasons. New York Times reporter Nellie Bowles recently covered the raw water trend. She joins us by phone. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Okay, Nellie, so what is raw water? It sounds horrible.
it is... Raw water is untreated spring water. So basically water that has not been filtered, it has not been UV treated or ozone treated, which is what most spring water goes through. And there's a movement in certain pockets of San Francisco, LA, really around the world since writing the story. It spurred this conversation that's made me realize how broad it is. But there's this movement to go spring hunting, get back to nature and go out and collect your own water. And then there's a company up in Oregon that is bottling some spring water and selling it for, you know, $15 a refill for your jar of it. But yeah, I mean, it's real. It's wacky though. I know.
What's the premise of it?
The premise is that, and this is one interesting thing is it brings together a lot of kind of very traditional and far right, like InfoWars attitudes about health and public services. So, okay, the premise is that fluoride in our tap water is bad and that the pipes, a lot of which are lead in the U.S., not a lot, but some of which are lead in the U.S. Mm-hmm. or are old, leach into our water, that treatment takes out the, how they would say, probiotics from our water. Again, this is all stuff that has not been backed by science.
Okay.
But a lot of these people are saying, like, you know, fluoride's a mind control drug.
Still? They're saying that? I mean, I know back in the 50s when they started fluoridating water, particularly in Grand Rapids, Michigan, is I think that's where it started. And I only know that arcane fact because I grew up there. But they were saying that back then. But what? Really?
You know, it dovetails a little bit with the anti-vaccine movement.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that. Yeah,
very much. And so it's that same sort of demographic and that same wariness. And then current events happen, like what is currently happening in Flint. And you read about how American water is not always good. American tap water is not always great. And so then that encourages this more extreme backlash. Where it's like, okay, well, then let's just have no tap water.
All right. So going back to the anti-vac movement, that's a highly educated demographic.
It is.
What do the experts tell us about this raw water that people are drinking? What do they make of it?
I mean, they don't like it. They're not supportive of this. It exposes you to all kinds of potential risks, of course. You don't know what is in a spring. You're not testing it. There could be Giardia. I mean, the list of things that could be in, you know, spring water, random bodies of water, is long. There's a reason why we treat our waters and people don't die of water-related diseases in the U.S. At the same time, one thing I've noticed since doing this story and kind of watching how the conversation's grown is people are, like, extremely horrified by this. It is not that crazy to drink spring water. Like, many communities around the U.S. drink spring water or well water. Or, you know, it's not all water goes through filtration processes.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, I know, but that's one thing to take a bath in it or that kind of a thing. It's another thing to drink it, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's risky. It's definitely risky. And it's the idea of, you know, spending hundreds of dollars a month on shipments of it seems eccentric, certainly. And then, also beyond just people collecting spring water, there's also a startup in Silicon Valley raised $24 million to help people install systems on their roofs that let them collect atmospheric water. And so you can collect your own water on your roof that then, you know, they set up a little tap inside your kitchen and you can drink water that you collect from your roof. And so it's part of this broader movement to get off the water grid, to not be reliant on water from the government.
Has anybody died yet?
Not to my knowledge, but certainly people have died from drinking raw water in the world.
Mm-hmm.
But not to my knowledge from these particular startups, which are, you know, the one that's doing the Silicon Valley one that is installing systems on your roof, mm-hmm. that goes through a filtration process on your roof.
Yeah.
And so that's treated in its own way. And then, the Live Water, the company that is shipping this from Oregon, you know, it's FDA approved. And I mean, that spring has been tested and is clean.
Okay.
So it's not, like, radical.
Know where you're getting your water from, but you said people are out looking for springs now.
Well, yeah. I don't know. I mean, I don't know all the spring hunters and how they're all faring, but the spring hunting as a weekend hobby is, that seems very risky to me.
It sounds like truffle hunting or something. But, you know,
it's just, it does. Yeah. Although, fundamentally, I get the impulse. Like, I understand the first of all, the fun of it, like going out and hunting for spring water and trying to drink water that to them tastes very pure. It's funny the way they talk about the waters. They talk about it like they're talking about wine. You know, they have different flavor profiles. I mean, I can't taste the difference between any of it.
So you've tried different kinds.
Oh, of course. My friend made me do, before we published the story, made me do a taste test. To see which one I like better, because I thought maybe that could be funny. And I unequivocally preferred the, in the blind taste test, the San Francisco tap water. But, well, that's probably because I grew up here and I'm used to it.
Why does it cost so much more, the raw water?
I don't know, like, kooky. It's like marketing and stuff. I think, I mean, you know, there is shipping costs and bottling costs and all that, but it's because it's special. It's weird. And people are willing to pay a lot of money. I don't know. You've wandered around Whole Foods before. Like,
yeah,
there's all sorts of overpriced, weird things.
And you're saying that raw water consumers, they have certain kinds they prefer and other kinds they don't. And they have developed a taste for it.
Oh yeah. And they'll talk about it. Like, you know, when friends come over, I bring out the good stuff, and
are you kidding me?
No, I'm not kidding you. I reporting live from San Francisco. This is what's happening.
All right, the fluoride thing. What do we know? I mean, is there a problem? I mean, besides
no,
the mind
no,
reading part of it, which is I don't know,
Fluoride is great for your teeth. Everyone agrees to that. It's a very small amount in the water. Fluoride is totally safe. But it's undeniable that there is a movement of people who are very wary of it and who see it as somehow at fault for a variety of society's ills. And so I think we need to look at that and understand what's happening.
Yeah.
And the sort of breakdown in trust that's happening.
Yeah.
And I think it's really telling about sort of our culture more broadly. But I always take things too deeply. It's also just like raw water.
after the Flint crisis, which was, you know, a serious problem and nothing to laugh mm-hmm. about, granted.
No.
But you can bet that right off the bat, we had a show here, a whole hour devoted to what's Columbus water like? I'm sure stations mm-hmm. across the country were having reports done on that. And they assured us that they keep the chemical balance the way it needs to be to avoid having the lead leach from the pipes.
People are worried. I think Flint really galvanized this movement that was already deeply wary of what the government was telling them about their water.
Yeah.
And what's happening in Flint has been a sort of a trust betrayal.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's not surprising then you'd see people act based on that.
Well, and then there was the algal bloom outside of Toledo like 4 years ago. And likewise, people were very troubled by that. And I know people in Toledo who are still using bottled water.
Yeah.
Same kind of a thing.
Yeah, I think so. I think, it's a really intimate thing, your water. It comes into your home. You drink a whole lot of it, or you're supposed to. And you're putting a lot of trust in your system that what you open your tap and what comes out is going to be good for you. And when people are anxious, they don't have that trust.
And the experts say, yes, but.
The experts say, like, definitely drink tap water. Please do not go spring hunting. You do not need to collect water on your own rooftop. The experts are pretty aligned. Yeah.
But are they alarmed?
Yeah, they are. They're alarmed about the spring hunting, certainly. You could be exposing yourself to any number of things in that water. And if you're not testing it, who knows? In the same way that there's a wariness around tap water, I would be wary of spring water because who knows what's in the environment around it. We don't live in a pristine world anymore.
Right. Exactly. Chemicals, salt. Everything.
Yeah. No, experts are pretty united in saying this is not a necessary thing to do, that tap water is very safe, and then you'll be alerted if it's not. But, it's
all things being equal.
Yeah.
Well, Nellie Bowles, thanks for joining us today to talk about this. It's never a dull moment. Nellie Bowles is a reporter for the New York Times. She's written about this raw water movement in the United States, around the world. We'll have a link to her article on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. Nellie, thanks again.
Hey, thank you so much for having me on.
We'll continue Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. January is the unofficial season of fitness and dieting, both popular New Year resolutions. But making those resolutions last even until February can be a challenge for a lot of people. Nutritionist, chef, and creator of the Nutrition Diva podcast, Monica Reinagle, has written about achieving healthy eating goals in 2018 on her blog, Nutrition Over Easy. She joins us by phone. Welcome back, Monica.
Hi, Ann. Great to be with you today.
Dieting tops countless resolution lists, and last week I talked about the U.S. News & World Report list of top diets. First of all, you don't even like the word diet.
No, and at least not the way we tend to think of it as a weight loss strategy. You know,
yeah.
Nutritionists use the word diet in the sense of dietary pattern. You know, so we might talk about the Mediterranean diet as a healthful way to eat, but that's not necessarily saying this is a weight loss plan. Now, if you can find a healthful way to eat, it should also help move you towards and help you stay at a healthy weight. So there's definitely some crossover here, but I think when people resolve to go on a diet in January, they're usually talking about weight loss. And my question is, why is it that this resolution tops the list year after year after year after year?
Despite...
because it doesn't ever, because making that resolution does not seem to lead to the kinds of changes that we need to make to solve the problem
of the epidemic of obesity in the United States.
Well, or even on a very individual level, resolving to go on a diet in January doesn't seem to lead to lasting changes in an individual's body weight. It may lead to a short-term change, you know, for a couple of weeks while you're fired up and you're following your whatever program. You might lose weight for a little while, but all too often, you know, eventually you go off the program and the weight comes back.
What are your strategies, or what do you tell your clients about how to stick with a good eating, how to make that change from a dieting weight loss goal to a dieting, a change, you know, or a healthy eating habit and pattern in your life?
Well, I think there's a couple of key things that I try to focus on, and one is slowing down the pace of weight loss, you know, setting different goals. We've been trained by the media and also to a certain extent and by our medical establishment to think that we should, if we need to lose weight, that we should be losing a couple of pounds a week. And what my research has shown is that this, you can definitely lose a couple of pounds a week on the scale if you're really diligent and you're, you know, you follow a restricted eating plan. You can do it. But what my research has shown is that it's not sustainable. For one thing, only a small fraction of what you're losing, of that 2 pounds a week that you're losing, is actually fat. A lot of it is water, and even more distressingly to me, a lot of it is lean muscle. So, and that, you know, sets us up for failure in the long run. So I think the number one thing that people can do if they're trying to lose weight is slow down. If you are losing 1 to 2 pounds a month, I think you're in the sweet spot. But that's a tough message to sell in a Biggest Loser world.
Yeah. You recently wrote about the best nutrition ideas of 2017, and one of them was mindful eating. What does that mean?
You know, I think that our culture has become more interested in this topic of mindfulness, not just about eating, but in all walks of life. You know, this used to be sort of a hippy-dippy thing that, you know, that yogis would do, you know, meditate and be mindful. But it has gradually crept into mainstream society, and now we all talk about being more mindful. And I think that this is a really positive development, and specifically for healthy eating patterns, you know, being more mindful can help us understand whether we're hungry when we're eating or whether we're eating just in response to some other cue, and also help us to tune into how we feel after we eat certain kinds of foods. And that awareness can help us make better choices that are not being driven by some sort of external set of rules, but a more internal sense of, you know, what serves me and how I'm feeling. And I think that that's been a very positive trend.
Why is it hard for us to figure out how we feel after we eat something? People, this isn't a long-term thing. This can be on a very short-term basis. Food can affect you, right?
You know, I think it's hard to get people to tune into how they feel about after having eaten a food because it's hard to get them to tune into the process of eating it in the first place.
or
even the moment at which they make a decision to eat it is often happening far below the conscious level. And I think that all of those decisions that are happening without our active participation are often not our best choices. So the problem of mindlessness starts way before we eat, you know, back in the in that moment when we're deciding to eat something. And often we're making that choice without even realizing that we're making a choice.
Okay, I've told you before that I eat too fast. That's pretty common,
yes,
too, among a lot of people now. Why is that?
Well, you tell me, Anne, why do you think you eat too
fast? It's because I grew up in a big family and you couldn't get seconds if you didn't eat fast.
So that's something I hear a lot. Another reason that people sometimes will give when I ask, why is it that you're eating so fast? It's because they feel like they don't have time.
Yeah.
You know, they have to get back to work or they have to. And I think that sometimes that can be a little bit of an illusion. We have more time than we realize.
Mm-hmm.
We're sort of teased into this sense of breathlessness by the pace of everything, by the, you know, the speed at which our phone dings and vibrates and, you know, and buzzes at us while we're trying to eat can kind of create this impression that we don't have a moment to spare. And I think we often can, it doesn't take 45 minutes to eat your meal mindfully. You know, you can eat a mindful meal in, I'll say 12 minutes, as opposed to 2 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason that that's helpful is not only are you more likely to notice that you're eating and enjoy it, hopefully, and you're enjoying what you're eating, and if you're not enjoying it, maybe you'd have the presence of mind to stop eating it, but you're also more likely to feel satisfied at the end of that meal because your body has had a chance to register the fact that you've taken in some calories.
How much do you think the speed with which we eat and a lack of mindfulness about eating is a function of how much we eat out and how much we eat fast food?
Well, certainly when you're in a distracted environment, that can lead to less mindful eating. So people will often report that if they're at a party,
mm-hmm.
That they will eat and drink a lot more than they kind of realize just because their mind is elsewhere. They're in a conversation with someone. They may feel a little anxious in a social situation, and so they find themselves kind of, you know, huddling close to the buffet table just to keep their hands busy or whatever. So
it's your friend.
Yes. So I think that being in environments where there's a lot going on, I mean, going to the movies and sitting there with a giant bag of popcorn in your lap, you know, how much of that popcorn are you actually conscious of consuming? You're sort of absorbed by what you're seeing on the screen. And this is why I think that, you know, another habit that I try to convince people to make, or at least try, is to not snack while they're watching TV or while they're scrolling Facebook or, you know, doing those very absorbing things, because you don't even notice that you're eating, much less how much you're eating. And a lot of unconscious calories get consumed in distracting environments.
A friend of mine who was a pretty devout vegetarian recently started eating chicken once or twice a week. She said she needed it to the protein because of her muscles.
Well, yes. I mean, the decision to eat a vegetarian diet or a strict vegetarian diet, especially a vegan diet where there's no animal protein, so no
mm-hmm.
eggs, no dairy, is usually not about maximizing nutrition. Usually it's for other reasons. People might have an ethical objection to eating animal products or a religious prohibition or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Because it really does look like, if you're looking at the human body purely from a biological point of view, the ideal diet would appear to include at least some animal protein. That said, we make our decisions about what we're going to eat on a lot of different criteria, and optimal nutrition may only be one of them. So, yes, including some animal protein in your diet can be a way to increase both the quantity and the quality of protein, and that can be really important as a way to, in fact, one of my top developments of 2017 was the recognition of protein as an anti-aging nutrient.
Anti-aging?
Yes. Does that surprise you?
I'm just happy to hear there is such a thing.
Well, of course, I'm tapping into a popular buzzword with yes. anti-aging nutrient. But we hear about antioxidants and things like that as being anti-aging. I really think that protein, as humble as that is, may be one of our chief anti-aging nutrients because, as your friend perhaps had read, eating more protein as we age can help prevent the age-related loss of muscle. And that, you know, that loss of muscle as we age is one of the primary factors that contribute to the sort of loss of vitality and strength and energy as we get older. So I think that's a great place to start.
You fell in love with brewed cocoa last year. What in the world? Is it like coffee? Is that what we're talking about?
Sort of a cross between coffee and hot chocolate.
Oh my gosh.
And I did kind of fall in love with it. I review a lot of new products and most of them don't impress me very much, but this one's really fun. So it's a way of processing cocoa beans, more like we process coffee beans. So if you want to try this, you can't just use your can of cocoa powder or even your cocoa nibs that you might have in your cupboard. You actually have to find some cocoa beans that have been specially roasted. They roast them at a much higher temperature, and they grind them up like coffee. And then you brew it. I use a French press coffee maker to brew it. And what you end up with is a beverage that there's no sweetness to it unless you add sugar. It looks like coffee and is calorie-free, but it has this rich, cocoa-y aroma. And it's also, although it's not completely caffeine-free, it's much lower in caffeine than coffee. And I really love it as an after-dinner drink. It kind of takes the place of both coffee and dessert.
I'm thinking of some vanilla-flavored almond milk to go with it.
Sure. You could add, if you drink your coffee with milk, then you might enjoy this with milk too. But even if you added a little splash of milk, you would still be, it would still be a much less caloric and sweet drink than, say, a cup of hot cocoa.
Wow, I'd love to try that. We're just running out of time, but I wanted to talk about your healthy lunch club idea. It's a trend that's been catching on in workplaces. What is it?
Yeah, I can't take credit for this idea, but I did also nominate it for one of the best nutrition ideas of 2017 that I hope will carry forward. And really, it's just people want to take their lunches to work because they know they'll eat better, but nobody has time. And so what people are doing are banding together in little co-ops where people will take turns bringing in lunch for their little group. So you might bring, a pot of soup or a pot of chili or, a tray of roll-ups or something. And then somebody else does it the next day. So you get to eat, you get the benefits of a homemade lunch every week, but you only have to cook it once a week.
Wow, I love that idea.
Isn't that a great? Maybe you could start something there at WOSU.
Maybe I could. I don't know. Shyla Knott, are you up? Thumbs up over there?
Okay. Shyla, you're up first.
Shyla's first, yeah.
Michael, you're second. And
Michael DeBonis, right. you just bring a crock pot in or you can make roll-ups or whatever you want to do. It doesn't, as long as it's...
Yeah, and there are whole Pinterest boards devoted to healthy lunch clubs if you need ideas for lunches that, kind of suit a variety of preferences and are portable and the kind of things that would adapt well to that, to the bring it from home environment. It doesn't have to be hot. Usually, if you're going to form a lunch club, you want to sit down and hammer out a couple ground rules. For instance, if there's one vegetarian in the group, then pretty much everybody has to agree to eat vegetarian lunches anyway. But, a little time setting up some ground rules, and it can be a really fun way. And while you're eating lunch together, it's an opportunity to be a little bit more mindful.
It hits a lot of bases. Well, Monica Reinagel, Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you, too.
And thank you so much for joining us.
Always a pleasure.
Monica Reinagel, nutritionist, chef, creator of the Nutrition Diva podcast. Check out the link to her blog on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. That's it for Wellness Wednesday. Thanks a lot for listening today. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.